Miss your favourite show? Then listen online at the RN website. And hello, welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you for the next hour. Happy Chinese New Year. Joining us also will be Glyn Johns. He is the sound man. Who, you say? Glyn Johns, the sound man? Well, think the Rolling Stones, think the Beatles, the Who, Joan Armour Trading, the Eagles, Led Zeppelin. The list really goes on.
Jimmy Page and I lived in the same town, and he was a remarkable guitar player even as a teenager, and it was a huge shock. I had no idea what I was walking into. Jimmy had rung me and said he'd put a band together with John Paul Jones, the bass player. I knew them both, and I knew them both to be remarkable musicians, but I had no idea what they'd put together with this band. Well, walking in and hearing them play the first song was just astonishing. It was hair-parting. I don't know if anybody who can remember listening to the first Led Zeppelin album the first time, or imagine being in the room with that when it was going on. It was just extraordinary.
I am imagining bliss. Yes, Glyn Johns, record producer for some of the most exciting acts of a generation, is going to join us on Life Matters today. Kicking off, though, with last year, the Federal Education Minister, Christopher Pyne, commissioned, you might recall, an advisory group to look at how we educate our educators, the quality of teachers in Australia, the quality of their teacher training as well. Well, that advisory group's report, called Action Now, Classroom Teachers Ready, or Teachers Classroom Ready, I think, recommends a new rigorous process to guarantee that universities provide good quality, practical classroom experience for pre-service teachers and that all courses are evidence-based. The suggestion of the review being that they're not at the moment. And if a university doesn't measure up, it could be the end of their teaching degree program. Is the advisory group on the right track? Are we right to expect a teaching degree alone to produce fully formed, job-ready classroom teachers? Joining us to talk about the review's recommendations is Professor Kim Beswick, who was a member of the Teacher Education Ministerial Advisory Group. Kim is Professor in Mathematics Education in the Faculty of Education at the University of Tasmania. Welcome, Kim.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us is Professor Stephen Dinham. He's Chair of Teacher Education and Director of Learning and Teaching at the University of Melbourne. He's also the President of the Peak Professional Group, the Australian College of Educators. Welcome, Stephen.
Good morning.
Stephen, 38 recommendations in this report. The advisory group's strong view is that some unis are offering poor quality teaching degrees. Some don't have proper quality practical components for those learning educators. They're not teaching according to evidence either. Do you agree with that overall assessment?
I think one of the things that we're facing is the fact that there's probably a growing disparity in terms of the provision of teacher education courses. We've had new entrants coming in, and I think over time, certainly there's been some concerns over the quality of courses. You can't look at them all and say they're all equivalent. I've been involved with assessing and accrediting courses in three states, and part of the problem is that the accreditation process is very low level. It's essentially a mapping exercise. You know, demonstrate where you're meeting the standard, and sometimes universities will take months and months to get their course finally accredited. So I've been a strong advocate of a much more rigorous approach to accrediting teacher education courses, but more than that, the courses themselves need to be based upon what we know is evidence on what works in teaching and learning. And I think that hasn't always been the case either. Unfortunately, education is subject to a whole lot of fads and fashions and ideologies and so forth, and we really need to ensure the quality of those courses and the quality assurance processes around those courses.
Well, it seems that then you do agree with the basic tenor of the report.
Well, I approve of much of it, particularly the notion of a strong evidence base and the need to get teacher education right. There are other issues too, though, such as the quality of who goes in. I mean, one of my arguments is that we need to address the issue of teacher quality at every key point of leverage that we've got, and that includes the quality of who goes in, the quality of the program itself, the quality of the in-school experience, the quality of what happens after people leave university and start working in schools. All of those things are important. It's not a quick fix, but certainly a strong evidence base should flow through everything we do.
Yes, Professor Kim Beswick, certainly evidence-based is a big part of this report. So is a national accreditation process to ensure that there is consistent standards in teacher education. Stephen's indication is that the standards aren't consistent. What did the review have to say about this?
Well, we basically agree with what Stephen said. There's the process is not consistent because it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and it does focus on the input, so what the program's actually doing, and it is essentially a mapping exercise in many cases.
What do you mean by a mapping exercise?
Well, just saying, this is in this unit we address this standard, and in this place we address this standard. What we're recommending in the report is that the emphasis is much more on the teacher that we produce at the end of it and what they can actually do. So it's more looking at the output of the program rather than the ingredients that have gone into it.
Yes. So you, part of the review's recommendations are you want every teaching degree to guarantee that pre-service teachers, trainee teachers, if you like, have practical experience in the classroom. It's staggering to me to think that some degree programs don't do that already or aren't doing it correctly.
They all do have practical experience, but it's not about just having practical experience, and it's certainly not even about the quantity of that experience. It's about the quality and what the teachers have an opportunity to engage with in that experience and how they're able to make connections between what they're learning in the university context and how that comes into play in the classroom, and being able to link those together is really, really crucial, much more important than the amount of time.
So where were the deficits in quality of that experience? Like what was the indication that those placements for trainee teachers just aren't really cutting the mustard?
Just concern expressed by many of the people who made submissions. Some of the employers around the place were a little concerned about that. There's also concern that because in some places at least it's difficult to find experienced teachers to place pre-service teachers with. So in some cases they get placed with any teacher rather than one who has the necessary skills and experience to mentor someone else. So it was those kinds of concerns.
Stephen, are we getting the practical component of teacher education courses right in Australia?
Well, I mean, just to follow on there from what Kim was saying, I think it's simply not a matter of days in school. In some cases with some faculties of education, the candidates have to organise their own placements. There's very little communication, collaboration between the university and some of these schools. Mm. Some programs are virtually all online. We really have to make sure
online,
that the interface...
The practical component is online? The whole degree program.
The whole degree and the supervision's online. It's part of this business I've mentioned where I think the gap between the top and the bottom is getting wider. We're becoming more like the USA. But the key thing is to really have a close collaborative relationship between the university and the schools. And what we've done at Melbourne is set up a network of schools. We fund certain positions. We have a very close alignment with our mentor teachers. And so on and so forth. And we also have a lot of time in school, so they spend 2 days a week in schools from the start of their program. But it isn't just that time, it's the common collaborative outcome that you're looking for, where everybody's on the same page, everybody understands what you're trying to achieve. So one of the problems that schools face is that they have candidates parachuting out of the air from all sorts of different universities, different standards, different means of reporting, different requirements for supervision. They tear their hair out, which is why we've tried to establish a relationship with a particular network of schools to really get that close understanding.
Yeah, so that actually you don't want those pre-service teachers, those training teachers, to be a burden on a school, do you, necessarily? But there is an element of burden to taking on a novice.
Well, there is. There can be, but one of the things that we've found is that the people who've been taking our candidates have actually been saying this is actually transformative for our school because we're prepared to work with them and listen to what they're doing and so forth. It's much more of a two-way process of knowledge, skill, understanding.
Well, there's a lot more to this review. Kim Beswick, let's come to the issue of lifting university entrance scores for wannabe teachers. This idea has its supporters, that those who are enrolling in education degrees should have a relatively accomplished marks leaving high school. Why didn't the advisory group end up recommending a minimum university entrance score for teachers, for teaching?
Well, basically, it's far too simplistic. An ATAR score doesn't apply to candidates going into graduate entry programs, of which, you know, there are many, and there are reasons why that, you know, they're a good idea in many cases. Many students going into four-year undergraduate bachelor programs also aren't allowed in on the basis of their ATAR. They may have worked in various sectors of industry before they came to teaching, and so year 12 was a very long time ago, so the marks would be irrelevant anyway.
But for those who are coming in straight from high school, would it not be useful to have a higher entry score to education degrees?
And again, even that doesn't necessarily reflect what they've done at year 12. That varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, so it would be possible, for instance, to get a very high ATAR score and not have studied mathematics at year 11 or 12. So,
and plenty of doctors have high ATAR scores, but and be very good doctors.
Exactly. There's more to teaching than just being smart. I mean, of course, we want intelligent teachers, but it's one of the range of things we want, and ATAR is just one measure of that anyway.
Stephen, the Australian College of Educators, of which you are the president, your submission to the inquiry recommended that an ATAR score of 70 should be a minimum requirement. What was your thinking there?
Well, it's more the national top 30%, top 25% that we see elsewhere. I mean, I'm not in favour of ATARs either, as a personal view, for some of the reasons that Kim gave there. I mean, the other thing that happens is that people find ways to circumvent the ATAR, so there are various bonus schemes and everything else. I do think we need very, very strong upfront standards. I don't think some sort of test at the end is sufficient. I mean, I've just come back from 3 months working in Germany, and they have a statewide examination prior to getting into teacher education training, and they have a statewide examination when they go out the other end. So I think that's the sort of thing we should aspire to. But just fixating on ATARs, I think, is counterproductive. The other point here is that we tend to focus on the lowest ones. We don't think about those courses which are requiring people with 93, 94. And again, we also don't concentrate on the fact that increasingly it's a graduate entry profession. I mean, again, just to hark back to where I work, but we are able to select people who have a distinction average in their undergraduate program to come into the program. Now, some people will tell you that it doesn't matter what people go into a program with, it's what they come out with. Both of those things are important. If you've got really bright people, it makes a big difference. And one of the points I think is really important with ATARs is that if you do have somebody who might have 35 or 40 or 50 or something, they will be teaching students who are potential 99.9 students. That can create problems.
Yeah. Speaking of those coming out the end of education degrees, Kim Beswick, another recommendation from the advisory group of which you were part is a national literacy and numeracy test for new teachers, so graduating teachers, doing these tests. Why?
It's largely about just ensuring that they do have the literacy and numeracy to meet the demands of teaching.
But they've done a whole degree. Surely they should be literate and numerate by that point.
Literacy and numeracy are fairly contextual ideas, so it depends. You can be literate for the context of your particular job, but teaching has particular demands of literacy and numeracy. There are particular contexts and situations that you have to deal with, and it's important that teachers can do that. And it's the kind of thing that's not necessarily addressed explicitly in courses, but we want teachers to be at that standard.
What if a new teacher, a graduating teacher, failed the test?
Well, that's to be worked out in the implementation. It's not clear yet whether the tests will be something that's a requirement for graduation or a requirement for registration or how that will work exactly. But they are things to be sorted through. And I think Stephen was right in alluding to the importance of making sure we don't let people into courses who are likely to be in that position.
Okay.
So the entry is important as well.
Stephen Dinham, there at the University of Melbourne, what do you think of that idea of testing the teachers as they're graduating on numeracy and literacy?
I'd prefer to see an upfront test. We do something ourselves at Melbourne called, we have an instrument called Teacher Selector, which includes literacy, numeracy and some aspects of personality as well. I think we need both, to be honest. I mean, we need really good quality control of the courses and demonstrated impact on teaching and learning more than just literacy and numeracy. But I think it's wrong to take people in with the possibility that, you know, they may not come out the other end. I think there's some bigger issues here, though, because one of the things that the report doesn't really get to is the issue of demand and supply, and the fact that we've had a deregulated system now in the undergraduate space with more and more teachers being trained or accepted into courses. And that, I think, has helped to drive down the entry standards. I do think we need to look very carefully at the notion of how many primary teachers we need, particularly the shortages in maths and science teaching in secondary, and we should target our resources. And I think if we have proper allocation of Commonwealth-supported places based upon demonstrated quality of the programs, we'll see the standards go up.
So, Kim, why didn't the review committee, the advisory committee, address that issue of demand and supply and the reality that the market's being flooded with a stack of teachers and there aren't the jobs for them?
Well, it's not quite true that the market's being flooded. There's more than enough teachers for certain subject areas and for desirable locations, but there are definitely shortages of maths and science teachers in secondary, and those shortages become far more acute when you move outside of metropolitan areas. So it's not a blanket oversupply of teachers. We also thought that many of the other recommendations about the quality of practical placements and so forth are likely to have some sort of limiting effect on the numbers anyway, because if those things have to be done properly, it restricts, I guess, the numbers that you can do properly.
But on the maths and science issue, you did actually recommend that primary teachers specialise in a particular subject, which is an interesting recommendation. It's a little bit more aligned with the approach with secondary teachers, just briefly and finally.
Yes, it is. It's not the idea that those teachers, the maths specialists in primary school, would do all the mathematics teaching and not teach anything else. They would be expected, the report has recommended, that they'd also be expected to teach across the curriculum. But they would be a resource within their school with some additional expertise in mathematics or science or whatever, who could help to build the capacity of other teachers. Because we recognise that the shortage of maths and science teachers is the end of a long chain of issues of kids disengaging with maths and science quite early on, around those middle years of schooling. So we need good quality maths and science teaching, and teaching of everything, in fact, right from the beginning, but particularly maths and science, because that's a real shortage and an area of need.
And giving teachers, young teachers, the confidence and passion early on is so crucial in those areas.
And access to an expert in their school is handy too, or nearby.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot to these recommendations, and I'm sure we'll look at them again on the program. Thank you to you both for talking about them with us. Kim Beswick, Professor in Mathematics Education, no less, at the University of Tasmania. Kim was a member of the Teacher Education Ministerial Advisory Group that has put together this report for the Federal Education Minister, Christopher Pyne, reviewing teacher education in Australia. And Professor Stephen Dinham, Chair of Teacher Education and Director of Learning and Teaching at the Uni of Melbourne. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I know you always have a lot to say about how we teach our kids and what you expect of teachers. So I'd like to hear from you on our Facebook page about this one. I'll pop a post up at the end of the show, and you can email us too, or you can comment on the story on our website. Just go to abc.net.au/rn. Look for Life Matters. Go to the story, add your thoughts there, and they'll get posted up. And our listener feedback line, 02833 1430. If you just want to get on the blower right now and tell us something, leave a message there. We'd love to hear from you. Life Matters is where you are. Natasha Mitchell with you here on ABC RN. And we're reflecting on the history of Australia's north. Next, with eminent historian Henry Reynolds.
Imagine you're a columnist for a big newspaper. The paper's struggling in the digital world, but it has a glittering history. Now imagine you find out the paper's spiking important stories because it doesn't want to upset advertisers. What would you do? Peter Oborne of Britain's Daily Telegraph resigned. On the Media Report, you'll hear from the editor who published his public goodbye. And literary journalism from the First Fleet to Federation. That's on the show too. I'm Richard Addy. Join me 5:30 this afternoon here on RN.
Happy Chinese New Year, folks. I'm looking forward to celebrating tonight with friends. Since this continent was colonised or invaded, by Europeans, depending on your perspective. Australia has been in, but not of, Asia. Over the past few decades, though, that picture has started changing. You might have a family who hail from Asian nations. Immigration has dramatically increased. Our biggest markets are, of course, now in Asia. And we're even the soccer champions of Asia, let's not forget it. With the 21st century dubbed the Asian century, we're often told we're in the right place at the right time to benefit from the future prosperity to our north. Thing is, that could have happened a whole lot sooner. That's the view and understanding of historian and author Professor Henry Reynolds. This Friday, NITV is airing an update on a doco called North of Capricorn. It's based on Henry's book of the same name. It tells a story of potent possibility and really of lost potential, snuffed out right at the birth of Federation. And Henry Reynolds joins us this morning in our Hobart studios. Welcome to the program.
Oh, nice to be here.
Let's paint that vision of the end of the 19th century from your research. Give us the picture. Give us the picture of the top end, the northern communities in Queensland, Northern Territory, WA. It was quite a different scene.
That's right. If you draw a line across the north from about, I suppose, where Mackay is now, right across to the Western Australian coast, it was clearly an area that was underdeveloped in European sense. But, I mean, firstly, the largest population was Aboriginal, many of whom had never seen Europeans. But in all the settlements, in all the towns, from Broome on the one side, right around to Townsville and Cairns and Mackay on the other, the towns were remarkably multicultural, multiracial. In fact, if you take the north, as a unit, the Asian population was certainly greater than the European population. There were very large communities of Chinese in particular, but also increasingly by 1900 Japanese. There were large populations of Pacific Islanders in the sugar districts. And it was, as I say, it was a remarkably multiracial society.
What was the attraction to the top end for those communities amongst our Asian neighbours, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Melanesian as well? What was the pull?
Well, I mean, the Melanesians had been bought as contract labourers, and many of them were still, but, I mean, a great many of them had decided to settle in Queensland. But the great attraction was that it was close. It was also familiar. That is, it was a... I mean, North Australia shares a monsoonal climate with Southeast Asia. It's also similar sort of areas that allowed the Chinese, for instance, to come in. They often came in as gold seekers, but they then turned their attention to doing things in, say, in and around Cairns that they would have done in southeastern China. That is, they became market gardeners. They became very large producers of tropical produce. They established a vast banana industry. They began building Chinese junks on the rivers to transport their bananas. And the other great advantage of the Chinese was that they had family connections both back to Southeast Asia, but also in a southerly direction to Chinese communities in Brisbane and Sydney. So you had this very remarkable example of Chinese enterprise, which was the most dynamic part of the economy in 1900.
Henry, what historical evidence is most potent to you to suggest that these communities all live together harmoniously, because we are at risk of romanticising this kind of cultural hodgepodge, if you like.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, well, to some extent, I mean, the main thing is there was a clear racial hierarchy, and there's also no doubt that there were periodic outbursts of tension and conflict, but there was much less than we once imagined. I mean, I had a very good PhD student who studied the Chinese in Cairns. And I kept expecting her to keep come up with all this evidence of conflict and tension, but there was very, very little, because the Chinese were very much embedded in the community, and they too had a sort of class hierarchy. There were very, very poor Chinese, but many of the Chinese were literate in Chinese. They had skills, but there were also a Chinese merchant elite that mixed with the European elite, and there were people who were wealthy. And the other point about the Chinese, that they were litigious, and they used the courts to defend themselves. So it's a very different picture to the picture they actually even had in the South, that all of these were just poor Chinese coolies. That was far from the truth.
Let's reflect on the relationship between these communities, and particularly local Indigenous and Torres Strait Islanders. We'll just play a little excerpt from the NITV doco that's going to air this week, North of Capricorn, based on your book of the same name. Let's hear a little of Darwin-based Aboriginal historian Donald Christofferson.
We were seasonal workers for the Indonesians 100 years before Cook even come close to this place. No one really knows the length of time that they were visiting here. Some people seem to think that they were visiting here a long, long, long time, you know, on the West Coast and even the Torres Strait, and they were visiting all different areas at certain times. But yeah, Macassans couldn't have done it without us. They needed to lease our land, they needed our resources, and they needed our labour.
It's Donald Christofferson, Aboriginal historian, from the documentary that airs on NITV this Friday, North of Capricorn. And Henry Reynolds, Professor Henry Reynolds, who's written a book of the same title, is joining us to reflect on the multicultural history of Australia's North and what changed. I mean, I'm interested in how then the present day reveals those early relationships, which, as we're about to hear, were transformed by early legislation in Australia. But what's the contemporary evidence of that intimacy?
Well, there are still families. I mean, there are still Chinese families who have been in the North, you know, since the 1870s and 1880s. There are still Chinese families right across the North. There are also many, many families who have of mixed descent, particularly many Aboriginal families right across the North who both know about but give evidence of having, you know, Asian ancestors, Filipinos, Chinese, Japanese. And in places like Thursday Island and Broome, you get that remarkable mixture of people that is apparent in the appearance of so many people in that part of Australia.
What happened at the birth of Federation under the first Prime Minister?
Well,
what changed?
Yes, Australia had been determined to be a white Australia from the 1880s, and the different colonies had passed legislation which was often just restrictive rather than prohibitive. But the new federation, I mean, in a way, the new federation saw as its one of its prime tasks was to enforce a white Australia. And that is exactly what they did.
So it was a very southern vision.
Oh, absolutely.
A southern-driven vision. It was actually a denial of what was happening in the North.
Yes, the South made war on the multiracial North and was determined that it would come to an end. And they knew and they admitted that this might mean that the economic progress would slow. Because, I mean, they also knew that the North was incredibly underdeveloped and with a very small European population, apart from the Queensland coast. But they were willing to accept that because they were determined to have a white Australia. And the two pieces of legislation, the Immigration Restriction Act, which stopped newcomers and stopped families refurbishing themselves through chain migration. But the other was the Pacific Islanders Act, which actually deported most of the Melanesians back to their islands. So legislatively, the new federal parliament set out to become a white Australia, and by and large it succeeded. That is, Australia in 1947 was infinitely more white and Anglo than it had been in 1897.
Including the top end.
Absolutely. I mean, the one place where white Australia failed was in the pearling industry. And they tried. They had ambitions to make it a white industry, but it never succeeded. So Broome and Thursday Island, the great centres of the pearling industry, continued.
Led by the Japanese.
Led by the Japanese. And so the pearling industry was the one area where white Australia was not successful. But otherwise, the resident populations, particularly the Chinese population, aged and dwindled, and these people weren't allowed to bring in relatives as they would have done had there not been such restriction on them.
Let's do a thought experiment and fast forward to the present day and what might have been if that white Australia policy had not been successful in the north.
Well, even if they had simply been restrictive rather than prohibitive, there would have been much more thrive. You know, the thriving non-European communities of 1890 and 1899 would have continued and undoubtedly would have grown. And I think you would have had much more dynamism, a great deal of commercial enterprise. That didn't happen. I went to the north at the end of white Australia in the 1960s, and in many ways it really was a backwater. North Australia was a backwater because it had shut shut the doors to its geographical location. So the north, I think, suffered through becoming more and more inward-looking and provincial. And it might have indeed been, as it is increasingly becoming now, the dynamic part of Australia because of its proximity to Asia and the Pacific.
So it's looking northward again. Is the south adequately looking northward again?
Well, not to the extent that you do if you live in Cairns or Darwin or Broome. You know how close you are, and in a way you appreciate either through trade or through tourism that your future is linked with the north rather than with the south. And Darwin in particular sees itself. I mean, Darwin in its promotional material says they are part of Asia, not just close to, but part of Asia. And they now, of course, celebrate the remarkable diversity of the new Darwin. But the new Darwin merely reflects what used to be in the 19th century.
Be interesting to see what's going to happen in the next 30 years. Won't it? I mean, we herald the Asian century, but in fact, a century ago, we had the possibility of an Asian century in the top end.
Well, yes. I mean, we had an opportunity which was squandered, and it was squandered largely for ideological reasons, not based on any, I mean, scarcely any of the legislators, the politicians who made these laws, had ever been in the north.
Been there. Oh, yes, it's such an interesting thought experiment to think what might have been different. Henry Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
It was a pleasure.
And of course, Henry Reynolds, historian and author, he's the author of North of Capricorn. North of Capricorn is also the name of a documentary that airs this Friday on NITV. Really well worth watching. It airs Friday, 7:30 p.m. And we'll pop the details on the Life Matters website. And you are with Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Coming up, I'm not going to tell you. You just got to stick around. But if you're a music lover, one not to miss.
It's a fine line between creativity and madness.
Making art, it might be good for the soul, but can it put your mental health at risk?
The romantic cliche is the more you suffer, the better your art. But there's a big difference between a cowgirl with the blues and a touring musician with crippling bipolar.
Art, mental illness, alcohol and anxiety. That's the subject on Fun Employed this morning at 10:30, part of Books and Arts.
Imagine it's the 60s, you're in a recording studio, you're the sound engineer, and a young band plays this.
Charlie's good tonight, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. The Rolling Stones. From Get Your Ya Ya's Out, recorded live at Madison Square Garden, 1969. They say if you can remember the 60s, you just weren't there. Joining me now is someone who was not only there, but if you take a look at his discography, it seems he was pretty much everywhere. Glyn Johns, a record producer and engineer, was the man behind the desks for the likes of the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the Clash, Joan Armour Trading, The Who, Eric Clapton, our very own Easy Beats and their huge hit, Friday On My Mind. All that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of the vinyl to his name. 50 years in the business, he started just as things were getting really heady. It's a story he shares in a memoir, Sound Man. Glyn Johns joined me earlier from Australia's City of Music, I would argue, in our Melbourne studios.
Good morning.
For a man who forged his career in rock and roll, I really love how your story starts in Epsom in a church choir, age
yes.
8. You almost ended up getting BBC airplay with your beautiful soprano voice.
I did, yes. My voice broke after the audition where I got the job. And so that was the end of that, yes.
You always wanted to sing, though, didn't you? You did want to become
a
singer.
Absolutely right, yes. Interestingly, when I was a teenager, like so many other teenagers, I wrote music and fiddled around with friends, but it never entered my mind that I'd end up in music as a profession. It was just something I really enjoyed doing. It was too far away, the world of music, as I was growing up. But my life led me to a job in a recording studio by a quirk of fate, and that's how it all started.
Yeah, fluke or good fortune. I do love that straight out of school, age 17, you stumble as a total beginner into the finest independent recording studio in Europe at the time.
Yes, absolutely. There's an amazing amount of good fortune throughout my career, and that's certainly the first. I ended up being trained by some of the best in the world as an engineer.
Who were they recording as you entered that studio, IBC?
Because it was an independent studio, we did all kinds of stuff. We did jingles for commercials, radio commercials, and we did film music. We did the popular music of the day, which was things like Al McCogan or the Johnny Dankworth Band, or you could be doing that one minute and 14 strings and a harpsichord the next. It was incredibly varied. And then along came the youth of the day with their rock and roll. And because I was the same age and understood it, I was sort of shoved into the seat to...
You understood it, but I do love how you started using free studio time on a Sunday to gather a few of the local lads. Just describe who those local lads were. One of them had turned up at your local church youth talent show when you were a kid as well.
Yes. Jimmy Page and I lived in the same town. And so we first met, I don't know, I guess I was probably about 14 or something like that. Anyway, I knew him really well and had followed him slightly. He was a remarkable guitar player, even as a teenager. And so he was one of the people. The word went round that I got free studio time, and everybody and their mother used to tip up who didn't have any money and who wanted to record something, and Jimmy was one of them, yeah.
Who else?
Oh, God.
Wasn't Eric Clapton in there?
No, Eric wasn't in there. No. I didn't meet Eric for quite a while. No, he wasn't. No, Jimmy was probably the most famous of that lot, I would think.
But you did meet, around this time, one key man who really did change your life, and that was Stu.
Yes. Ian Stewart, the keyboard player in the Rolling Stones, he put the band together originally with Brian Jones. And he and I lived very close to each other, and we met socially, and then I discovered he played the piano, and we shared an interest in the blues. We ended up actually sharing a house together when I left home. And I obviously knew about the Rolling Stones because he was in the band, and I had a little club that I used to run on an alternate Friday with the band that I was in. And we decided that we'd start a rhythm and blues night on the alternate Friday. And the Rolling Stones was the band that we put in there. And I think about four people turned up. on three consecutive Fridays, or two consecutive Fridays. And then we thought, well, this obviously isn't a very good idea. It's a bit early for Rhythm and Blues in Sutton in Surrey, which is where we were. So that I think I'll go down in the annals of rock and roll history for paying the Rolling Stones 30 shillings for a gig.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I eventually took them in the studio and made their first recordings, and then that ended up, that led to me working with them for the next 15 years.
15 years. What a relationship. How would you describe the relationship with them? And this is the backdrop of the early 60s you describe as being the Wild West. This is the music industry of the music business of the early 60s, the Wild West. And here you are recording, you know, the Rolling Stones' first records, really.
Yes. The reason I described it as being the Wild West is because I suppose the youth that had taken over broke all the rules, one. And because of the nature of the music changing and so many young people being involved, a lot of older people who were already in the business took advantage. There wasn't the structure that there is now, anything close to. There weren't lawyers that specialised in the music business, for example. So a lot of kids got taken advantage of by fairly unscrupulous people in the early days. Anyway, that's nothing to do with recording the Rolling Stones. So working with the Stones for that period of time was interesting, to say the least. It was extraordinary. One never quite knew what was going to turn up, of course. It was very exciting, of course.
You were quite straight. You didn't take drugs at all throughout your career. You were surrounded by musicians who were totally bent.
Yes. Bent, I don't know.
Stoned, high,
yes, okay.
Losing the plot, falling about.
No, absolutely. It was pretty strange. No, I never did take any drugs. And frankly, if you do what I do, if you're me anyway, you can't do that. You've got to have your wits about you, really. And I'm pretty sure that's one of the reasons why I got as much work as I did, was because I was a reliable soul in the room, as it were, rather than being tainted by some other substance.
Yeah, but Glyn, I love the way you describe those recording sessions with the Rolling Stones. It sounded like a very organic process, actually, how they used the studio space. So how did that mean you worked with them?
Well, things change. They were the first people who would work all night, for example, that I can remember. It was normally studios closed at 10 o'clock at night would be the latest you'd be there. But the Rolling Stones started working at 8 in the evening and would go all night long. Some members of the band were better at turning up than others, on time, that is. They would write in the studio. That was another thing that was pretty unusual. Mm. Prior to that, people had material prepared and rehearsed and everything else before they got there. And they used the recording process to create a song as they went along. And actually, that was really quite interesting. It was quite boring on occasion because it did take rather a long time.
But didn't one of the band members say that, you know, they spent 50 years recording together or something, 30 years, and 20 of them was actually, you know, sitting around doing nothing?
It was Charlie was asked that. I think it was down here in Australia, actually. He was asked that question. What's it been like on their 50th anniversary? And he said, well, it's been 10 years of working and 40 years of hanging around, or the other way around, I can't remember which. But I thought it summed it up rather well, actually.
Glyn Johns is my guest on Life Matters this morning. He's the author of Sound Man. He is the Sound Man, a life recording hits with the Rolling Stones, The Who, Led Zeppelin, The Eagles, Eric Clapton. Led Zeppelin, what was the experience for you in first hearing them play metres away from you?
It was a huge shock. I had no idea what I was walking into. Jimmy had rung me and said he'd put a band together with John Paul Jones, the bass player. And I'd known John Paul Jones for years because he was a session bass player. So I knew them both, and I knew them both to be remarkable musicians, but I had no idea what they'd put together with this band. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said, would I go in and do it? Well, walking in and hearing them play the first song was just astonishing. It was hair-parting. I don't know if anybody who can remember it listening to the first Led Zeppelin album the first time, or imagine being in the room with that when it was going on. It was just extraordinary.
Glyn, the hair, every single hair on my arm has gone up straight, perpendicular.
It was amazing. And we made that record. They were so well rehearsed. We made that record in 9 days.
The Beatles, in fact, your connection to them started with an unexpected phone call from a man with a very Liverpoolian accent.
Yes, yes. Yes, I answered the phone on a very rare night off, and there was a Liverpudlian voice said, could he speak to me? And I thought it was Mick Jagger taking the mickey. So I said, for God's sake, what do you want? You know, because he never rang me unless he wanted something. So the voice went quiet, and it turned out to be Paul McCartney. And I've sort of had to bite my foot. I've never been so embarrassed. Anyway, it was completely out of the blue, and he asked me if I do Let It, what became Let It Be, which I did, of course.
And something about those voices combined was just special.
Yes, it's fairly obvious, really. But they each in the band had very different voices, but the combination of all of them was pretty remarkable. It's the same with the Eagles. I think the sound of the Eagles was very much the vocal blend they got. And again, the singers in the band all had completely different voices, but the combination of all four of them, in the case of the Eagles, was just remarkable and very original and most unusual.
I have to touch on punk because that's my heritage. You don't really care much for punk.
No.
But you did work with The Clash, and they seemed to change your mind just a little bit.
Well, they were a quite exceptional band. And it just shows you how blinkered one can become. I was sort of forced to listening to them because I was sent a double album they'd made by CBS Records, and with the view of me mixing it. And they asked me if I'd at least take a listen to it, having said, no, I'm not in the least bit interested. So I listened to it, and I'd never really listened to them before, to be honest, and learnt that, in fact, they were quite remarkable in what they were doing.
And lovely gentlemen,
well,
as it
seems.
Joe's
drummer, absolute sweetheart. Yeah, fantastic, mate. Really lovely guy. Very, very bright man.
And sadly, he left us too early.
He sure did.
He sure did. And I'm reminded, reading this book, A Sound Man, of how many people have left us in the industry that were so close to you. So it must have been, there's a lot of emotion over these years as people drop off, I guess. And what also has changed, and you point to this, the synthesizer, the drum machine, they really gave you the pip. The radio playlist, that really changed things. All these things made you despair, I sense, as they arrived on the scene. And I'm wondering then, Glyn, what you make of the industry now and of your role now.
Well, interestingly, I don't really relate to the way records are made now, in as much as people are separated. They don't very rarely play together. Mm. So there's very little interaction between the musicians. And when a musician is recording on his own, he's reacting to what's gone before, basically, he's only influencing what he's doing. He's not influencing what's gone before. To me, the joy of music as I like it is the interaction between musicians when they're playing with each other. And that's very rarely achieved now, it seems. I think the way records are made now, people are brilliant at it. I mean, they make some astonishing stuff. And think nothing can stand still. I mean, I'm going to sound very boring, I suspect. But I still enjoy working as much as I ever did, in fact, maybe even more. And frankly, I haven't changed my methods at all.
The technology's changed to an extent.
Well, the technology's changed dramatically, but I still record analog, for example,
on
tape. So, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, how delicious.
Yeah absolutely. And it makes a massive difference to the sound. I think the saddest thing is that the norm now is the quality of recorded sound is not nearly as good as it used to be based on what digital does to it, really.
It's all just noughts and ones skipping a beat, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, it's there isn't the warmth in the sound now that there used to be, and that's a drag. And so by recording analog, you at least get some of that before it's turned into digital when it's put onto a CD.
But is that romantic? I mean, we've lost the romance of that warmth, I think, because we don't know it existed if we're not vinyl listeners.
No, absolutely. And I mean, most people, I don't think most young people now really care. We used to buy an album, sit down and listen to it end to end on the best sound system we could find. If we didn't have one ourselves, we'd go around to our pals who had a great sound system. And you'd sit there and you'd watch it like, or listen to it rather like you would watch a movie. Nowadays, that doesn't exist. People listen to one track at a time, or maybe not even that. They listen to it on earphones that fit in your ear that don't reproduce bass very well, for example. So they don't have the same oral experience. And I guess that's okay, but it's people are missing out. I know that in England, anyway, that vinyl is having something of a resurgence,
yeah.
as it is in America. I don't know if it is in
Australia. Yeah, I think I would say it is here too.
It would be that's brilliant, because the difference between vinyl and the CD is just massive.
Is there any one person of all these incredible musicians that you've worked with over a long career now that really makes your heart swell at the memory of working with them, that just has left an imprint that's profound in a special way?
I have to tell you, there are numerous.
Mm.
Ryan Adams would be one. Very, very recently. He's a remarkable singer-songwriter and just incredible to work with. Joan Armatrading probably made a
She's
made
joined
a
us
massive...
on Life Matters. What a wonderful...
Oh, really?
She
great.
Wouldn't
yeah.
play. She wouldn't play.
Yeah.
What a woman.
Yeah, extraordinary. She really was amazing to work with. I mean, there have been lots, but that'll do for the minute, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us for just a minute. I know there are many more stories that you tell. It's been wonderful having you on the program. Enjoy Melbourne. Enjoy Australia. Thank you, Glyn Johns.
Thank you very much. Keep it right across our shoulder.
Oh, yeah, the Rolling Stones, Honking Tonk Woman. And wonderful to speak to Glyn Johns, record producer, engineer for some of their early records amongst so many other artists. God, you can read about it all in his memoir, Sound Man. It's published by Blue Rider Press. He's in Australia at the moment. You might catch him somewhere. I'm not sure whether he's appearing publicly, but fantastic to have him on the show. You might remember some of those albums with much love. It was great actually preparing for that interview because I got to play a whole lot of music at home as I was going. Michael Cathcart is joining you straight after the news for more music, art, creative expression. Good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning. Do you have a turntable at your house?
Oh, now look, it's a really delicate issue.
Oh,
I got rid of it in a recent house move.
Oh, no.
I know, I'm actually quite traumatised by this.
I just got mine fixed up.
And my cassette deck. I feel quite traumatised by it.
Oh, you could lose the cassette deck, I think. That's never going to come back. No one's ever going to say, you know, the quality on cassette. That was really
yeah,
special.
But there was nothing quite like a mixtape as an expression of love.
Oh, yeah.
Making a mixtape for a friend was just a beautiful way of telling them how much you love them.
Tell the young people that today.
Oh, now, come on. I'm hip.
I know.
I'm all digital. I just, you know, analog, digital. We can do it both.
You're across it all.
Hey, what's coming up?
Oh, we're going to talk about Archie Meston, who's an amazing character from 19th century Australia who toured with a vaudeville show of Aborigines.
The Wild Australian Show.
That's the one.
Coming up, Michael Cathcart, straight after the news, books and art. Stay with us right throughout the day. It's 10 a.m. I'll catch you tomorrow.